Hello and welcome to the final draft books and writing on 2SER. I'm Genevieve McGregor. And I'm here with you for the next half hour, and it's the second week of 2SER's annual subscriber drive. So I hope you can stay tuned, switch on, and subscribe to support us this evening.
In the not too distant future, there will be no civilization. There will be no heroes.
They say people don't believe in heroes anymore. Well, damn them, human D-backs. We're gonna give them back their heroes.
In the not too distant,
I've seen things people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Ten Hauser Gate.
We have a great show for you tonight, all about dystopian fiction. Think apocalypse, societal collapse, totalitarianism and rebellion. Think George Orwell's 1984 and the films Mad Max and Blade Runner. We heard a bit from them at the beginning of the show. Well, tonight we'll be looking at some authors who deal with those themes, with some great giveaways thrown in, of course. First up, Neda Vanovac looks at the wave of young readers gorging themselves on dystopian fiction. Katrina Menzies-Pike talks all things Grimm and J.G. Ballard, author of Crash and Empire of the Sun. And finally, leaving dystopias for a bit, Kim Tan chats with Toby Leon about the adaptation of The Slap for ABC TV. And for anyone who's read the original book by Christoph Solkus or seen the three episodes now that have aired on the ABC, you might see some similarities between the dystopian themes and the unravelling of the characters' lives of The Slap. On the great giveaway front, everyone who phones in and subscribes tonight goes into our major prize draw. It's a pretty amazing prize that will take care of all your entertainment needs for an entire year. There's theatre, movie, live music tickets, and CDs galore. It's only $35 for concessions, $70 for all you working folk. And if you are an incredibly passionate 2SER fan, that's $150. So call now on 9514 9500. That's 9514 9500. And I hope you can stay tuned. You're listening to The Final Draft on 2SER. It's Sydney, a place of sweltering heat and violent storms, where water is a precious resource and those in power prey on the young. This is the setting for Alison Stewart's novel Days Like This, which in a time of global warming, shortages in water and an increasing ageing population, it doesn't seem that far-fetched. Days Like This is aimed at a growing young adult readership that just can't get enough of dystopian worlds. And perhaps the attraction comes from how familiar the unfamiliar can be. That in the almost overdrawn brutality and tyranny, we see our world and what it could become. From a safe distance, of course. Neda spoke with Alison Stewart and American author Maria V. Snyder about what attracts this audience to these post-apocalyptic stories.
If you take a little look at what the kids are reading these days, you could be forgiven for thinking that the world is ending. Again. Because after the vampires and the zombies come the dystopias, and young adult readers are lapping them up like never before. We live, after all, in a world of increasing paranoia and surveillance, of sophisticated technology, rampant consumerism, and environmental uncertainty. There are disease epidemics, tsunamis, wars being fought with robots, and the whole thing seems to be on a fast track to, well, nowhere good. And it would be a mistake to think that young people aren't noticing that adults don't seem to have quite as good a grip on things as they think.
Yes, I think so. I think that was one of the things that I was really amazed about when I was younger. I always thought that once you got to an adult, there wouldn't be any of those petty things going on, like the cliques and the popular kids and the jocks and everything, and that they would be so much smarter and everybody would be really nice. And it wasn't true.
That's author Maria V. Snyder, who has written Inside Out and its sequel Outside In, set in space as a giant cube goes hurtling through the galaxy. On board are a few thousand people living in a highly stratified society of uppers and scrubs, and the pop cops who keep them in line.
And I met adults that they're not that intelligent sometimes. They do some really stupid things, and it was like, oh, so my expectations of adulthood were nothing like reality. But I think today's kids know that. And I tell my kids all the time, you know, just because they're an adult and they tell you something doesn't mean that they're right.
Dystopian books such as the Hunger Games series are flying off the bookshelves as younger readers gorge themselves in post-apocalyptic and sci-fi scenarios where the world looks a lot worse than the one they're inhabiting. These kinds of stories may not be new, but to this wave of young adult readers, they are.
Everybody's saying about how the economy's bad and your politics is bad and, you know, it's going to get worse. And I just think it might be bad now, but it could be really bad. You know, you could be put in an arena and told to kill 23 other people.
Dystopias are about perspective. Alison Stewart is the author of Days Like This. Set in a future Sydney of sweltering outdoor temperatures and violent storms, water is a commodity to be guarded. Troopers patrol the city and punish rule breakers, and a committee have taken over, turfing out those with no useful connections and building a wall around the waterfront suburbs. They're pursuing power and eternal youth at the cost of the young people who are being harvested in horrifying ways. She saw many parallels between her home country of South Africa and dystopian worlds.
It was very hard leaving that country because it's a beautiful country, but it was a huge relief to get out of a very unequal situation. And I suppose that sort of unequal world with great disparity in wealth and social inequality, economic and political inequality, works very well in the dystopian world because, you know, obviously there are things about Days Like This, things that are very consistent with fascist dictatorship. The wall, you know, which is obviously a physical symbol, like the Berlin Wall, you know, wherever there's a fascist world, obviously people need to have ways and means of keeping people. So the black troopers, for instance, were very symptomatic of Hitler's SS or, in South Africa, the apartheid regime's Bureau of State Security.
The boom in dystopian fiction could be explained by a simple need for escapism. Maybe young people are so saturated in shades of grey in today's world that they want to take refuge in a universe where things work in binary absolutes. They know the world they're inheriting is going to be a great deal less certain and secure than it is now. The funhouse mirror of dystopias holds up a distorted alternate reality for young people to look into.
I've always loved worlds where things are not right, you know, and where you can look at those worlds and say to yourself, what if our world progresses towards that? What should we be doing? And also, I think dystopian fiction is a very political genre, and especially for young adults, it's great if young readers can read and just have some self-examination and say, what am I doing? Is there anything I could be doing to stop what I might be seeing in our society, like inequality, economic, political? What could I do? Rather than just stepping back and wanting to read romance, which is fine, but these are hard issues, and I can see some people might not like it. They want to read about just the world that we exist within, you know, rather than looking at it's dystopian world is scary.
The kids are very structured these days. We keep them busy so they can't get into trouble. They are required to be at certain places at certain times because then that way they don't have any free time or downtime to get into trouble. The more you try and structure things, the more people will try and break out of that structure, I think.
Teen dystopian writer Scott Westerfield in the New York Times argued that teenagers are at a stage of life where they deal with almost adult responsibilities but haven't been granted adult power or respect. They're encouraged to work at menial jobs, they're carefully watched, assumed to be shoplifters and loiterers. They're subject to dress codes, have few free speech rights, and are constantly surveilled while they rise and sit at the sound of a bell. And what they really crave, it seems, is power.
It is about the uneven distribution of power always. Dystopia is about that. Young readers, I'm sure they are aware, but need to be aware that they have the power. You know, we're in a democracy. They have the power to stand up and decide what sort of society we want. Young adult dystopia springs out of the issues of today that are taken a few steps beyond, you know. So things, for instance, like our seeming inability to deal with environmental vandalism that's happening, you know, global warming, or this huge and ever-growing disparity between the rich and the poor, and you see the London riots, you know, they can't be justified, but on the other hand, there is a reason for them.
And so in young adult dystopias, we see young people taking back control and putting up a fight.
If you have a sappy heroine or hero, it's not going to work. You have to have someone who is empowered, you know, someone who who within this horrific world can step up and fight in their own way. That's why people say, oh, dystopia is so barren and bleak and awful and violent and so on. Well, yes, it is those things. But inevitably, especially in young adult dystopia, for young adult readers, I think it's good for them, if they choose to read it this way, to have a look and say, yes, all these rules and regulations, but here is a character who can slice through them like a hot knife through butter. You know, it can be done.
It's been suggested that there's a surge in dystopias for young people because adult dystopias are too bleak. 1984, Brave New World, there's no redemptive message for humankind. But authors, or maybe publishers, seem reluctant to allow young adult fiction to end on such a negative note. Says Maria V. Snyder.
I think there's always hope, especially for YA. I mean, they never end in a crushing, like, horrible way. I think I always leave it open for things are going to be better, because I always think things are going to be better.
I see something shining there.
But do you think that shining thing is something that belongs more to the kids? Is that something in them that... Is it something that writers are looking to preserve, to not hit them over the head with the world's going to hell in a handbasket,
yes,
but more like a, it's bad, but maybe.
Yes. Well, definitely, because I actually believe that. I think our world's gone through a lot of horrors over the centuries, and we're incredibly adaptable. You know, that's why we're the number one species. We've survived, and we, in the end, our values seem to reassert themselves, and so I think it's quite valid.
But Alison Stewart warns against getting too prescriptive when reading into dystopian fiction.
In the end, it's supposed to be a book. It can also just be a good read. It's just a story, and that's exactly how you can read it.
That was Neda Vanavak speaking with Alison Stewart, author of Days Like This, and Maria V. Snyder, author of the Inside Out and Outside In novels. And you're tuned in to SER's book show, The Final Draft. For all those regular listeners and podcasters out there, I hope you can find the time and the spare change to call up and subscribe to support great independent radio. The number is 9514 9500. That's 9514 9500. Or you can go to our website and follow the links. It's 2ser.com. Go on, do it. You might even win something. Now, tonight we've been talking about dystopias, and I can't say I know many dystopian rom-coms. So why is it that a dystopia, just because it's not a utopia, has to be so grim? I mean, when you think about it, most utopias turn out to be dystopias in the end. So where exactly did both of these things, dystopias and utopias, come from? Katrina Menzies-Pike talks Difficult Worlds and the fiction of J.G. Ballard.
It's dystopia week at Final Draft. We're stuck in a bad place. Fortunately, it's a bad place where there's plenty to read and lots of films to watch. As a literary genre, dystopias are a bit of a movable feast. The category of dystopia is so broad and stretchy that it can stick pretty easily to all manner of fictions. Fictions which imagine all difficult worlds, often but not always recognisable variations on our own. They do this for the purpose of some sort of political critique. The name of the genre makes reference, of course, to utopias, but in a dystopia we're about as far away from utopias as we can get. The utopia was given form in English letters in the book Utopia by Thomas More in 1516. This is a book which describes an ideal republic, a fictional island in which everything works well, better than expected even. A utopia is a no place. It's somewhere fictive. But the U in utopia is also drawn from eudaimonia, the Aristotelian concept of the good life. Utopias are hippie, dippy, happy, functional places. They're fair. They're nice places. But you'll probably never get to live in them. Dystopias, on the other hand, are more familiar. The English word is a combination of two Greek roots, dys, or bad, and topos, or place. So a dystopia really is a bad place. I think it's fair to say that we encounter dystopian fictions more frequently in contemporary literature than we do utopias. We're more interested, perhaps, in imagining a way things could go terribly wrong, and perhaps give less credence to visions of places where everything goes right. Political utopias like Francis Bacon's 1826 New Atlantis give away to dark political visions like George Orwell's 1984 and Animal Farm. The term dystopia is broad enough to catch a lot in the net. In fact, whole genres are often shelved, not always entirely neatly, as dystopias. Science fiction, for example, or speculative fiction, if you'd rather. Sci-fi on screen has helped too. It's given us a visual rhetoric for dystopias that's hard to shake. Think of the dark urban labyrinths of Blade Runner and go from there. Dystopian fiction can take us across the galaxy or into warped, difficult inner psychological spaces. The bad places envisaged in contemporary dystopias may challenge our sense of the present precisely because they are so familiar. The work of British writer J.G. Ballard is a pretty solid reference point for dystopian writing in English. If you're trawling for travestied, shocking, outraged, brilliant reimaginings of our world and norms, Ballard's long portfolio of fiction and non-fiction is a good place to start. As a primer to dystopian fiction, Ballard is interesting too because his writing started off looking across the galaxy and distorting time and space and gravity to present other worlds and critique our own. Where it ended up is in places that look a lot like the fraught suburbs and small towns of contemporary England. Early fiction by Ballard, like The Drowned World and The Crystal World, blasts through crystal beaches, through hard-edged landscapes which blossom like a set of crystals. The forces which shape the physical environments, like nuclear energy, decay, neglect, heat, these become cosmic entities and with some sort of social force. It's a strange world in which abandoned constructions, abandoned human constructions like bunkers and arenas, appear without explanation. So much so-called war, I guess. It's not unlike the post-annihilation visions of Kurt Vonnegut in Cat's Cradle. In an introduction to a 1994 book of short stories, Myths of the Near Future, Ballard writes of his work that it's a set of windows onto a future world, an observation car from which we can look out at the intriguing and uncertain terrain where we'll spend the rest of our lives. The observation car moves from the entirely speculative into a place which is more familiar and more disturbing as his career moves on. The fragmented experimental fiction of the late 1960s and 70s, on which Ballard really made his name, presents shattered images of consumer culture. It's an approximation of the present where the surfaces are distorted to reveal an unnerving and violent core. The car crash is the exemplary event here. The human meets the mechanical in a totally weird, eroticised collision. It's the scene of a violent kind of hybridisation. It's kind of sexy, and it gets sexy when celebrities get involved. Form is shattered on the way. Linearity is supplanted by fragmentation, repetition, distortion. It's hard not to feel disoriented in this particular literary space, a difficult place to be. Which is why the bigger novels that Ballard wrote at the end of his career are in many ways a lot more comfortable. They explore the mores of the middle class in a pretty tangible fashion. The world they describe is quite accessible, the plot is more or less linear, the characters are friendly, and the world is deeply messed up. It all looks nice enough, but these surfaces conceal something far more sinister, which is why it's exciting and necessary, I think, to look at the base of experimental fiction from which they emerge. Just as the surfaces of middle-class life, nice clothes, charming family, flat-screen TV, are a shroud to hypocrisy, sexual perversity, violence, drugs and cruelty, so the surfaces of these conventional dystopian fictions conceal a far more radical narrative engine, one that's driven by ambivalence, spiralling ironies and disdain. It's difficult terrain to occupy, and it doesn't really allow for easy political or philosophical resolution of the events on show. Ballard's novels about football violence or gated communities or plastic surgery or celebrity culture don't present easy villains. In fact, the do-gooders are generally just as conflicted as the characters who are more recognisably messed up. This is a dystopianism which doesn't really allow any oases. The bad places of Ballard's fictions cover the whole world, and maybe that's what's so unsettling about them. There's no heroes, there's no way out. There is a coda. J.G. Ballard died in 2009. His last work was a memoir, Miracles of Life, and that was published in 2008. There's a change in tone here. It's even more gentle than his very well-known memoir, Empire of the Sun, which was made into a movie by Steven Spielberg. Miracles of Life is a memory of a life in writing and of the happiness of family life. After the wrenching encounters of his fiction, its coda suggests which it might not all be so bad, that the dystopias may not be the only place for us.
That was Katrina Menzies-Pike talking dystopias. Now, before we go tonight, we're leaving dystopias for a look at the adaptation of Christos Tsokos' 2008 novel, The Slap. The series, like the book when it was released back in 2008, has received quite a bit of media attention. It follows the repercussions of a single event, a slap, upon a group of family and friends. And it's always interesting to find out which side you and your friends are on this one. Toby Leon is a master's student whose dissertation analyses Tsokos' body of work. He reviews The Slap with 2SER's Kim Tan.
The Slap wasn't my favourite of Tsokos' novels, but, I mean, the book, for me, it wasn't as potent as his other novels. The TV series, on the other hand, I'm really enjoying it. I think it's actually, it's a stroke of genius. There's a texture to film that's completely different, obviously, from literature, and somehow it feels like you get more of a sense of character in the TV series. They're just little nods that you get throughout it, and I suppose we'll talk about them, but I'm actually really enjoying the series.
I guess with Tolkien's work, it is very visual. Like, you do imagine it straight away as you're reading it. Something like The Slap, which he wrote, it's almost like he wrote it in one sitting and it's just blurted out, and so you just imagine this, the scenes as they go, and it's like a run, continuing kind of filmic stream. I guess as whenever you translate a written text to something on screen, there's always the risk that the story and also the relationships between the characters don't really get translated across. I mean, it is a bit of a slow burn to start off with. What's your opinion on that? Do you think someone who has never read the book would be able to get it straight away?
Well, this is the thing. I don't think it's about getting it straight away. And I think that's the thing that you have when you sit down and read a book, is it's not about getting it straight away. You do have to read the whole thing all the way through and then think about it. In TV, we're so used to having these arcs, especially in TV series, where you have this entry point that starts at the beginning and it's just kind of very calm, and then it goes up and then it goes down and then it goes up and then it goes all the way up, and you have to wait for the next episode. Whereas this series, I mean, you have The Slap in the first episode, so it's really all about the reverberations that happen afterwards, but it really is about getting an insight into all of these different people, and it's a take on modern Australia. So for me, as someone who really enjoys to kind of luxuriate in characters and get down to the nitty-gritty, I really appreciate the fact that it's quite a slow burn. I actually like that. This, it stayed with me, actually, and I think it's because it's so character-driven.
Speaking of characters, there are 8 episodes and each is named after a different character because they're the, I guess, the central force that's driving along the episode. Episodes 1 and 2 we're going to talk about tonight, which are Hector and Anouk. So maybe we'll talk about how Hector and Anouk relate to each other and why they're central characters in the plot.
So it's Hector's birthday party that everyone's come to in the first episode for the barbecue, and he's Aisha's husband. And then Aisha and Anouk have been friends since they were like 15, 16, I think, so a very long time. In terms of their relationship, there's definitely, I mean, I got a sense that there was some kind of sexual tension between them. It's not explored, but there was definitely some flirting, and I mean, Anouk gives him some coke when she arrives at the party as well. So there's
cocaine, not the drink.
Yeah, cocaine. Mm. Sorry, not the drink. Yeah. So there's a lot of history between them. I mean, I think they're in their, he's just turned 40, but I think they're all around about that age, late 30s, early 40s. So, I mean, they've known each other for decades.
I think it's interesting, too. Both characters are quite vain. So he's kicked off the first 2 episodes with the vainest 2 characters, I would argue, who are very aware of their age, their status, their looks, and their sexual attractiveness to the opposite sex and people around them.
They did.
Their sexuality.
They definitely did.
So you're really, I think it's almost a interesting point of society to take you from the outside and also the most superficial level for these 2 characters, because they're essentially reflecting a lot of the insecurities the other characters the series will look at.
Well, it is really interesting that they started with those two characters. Obviously, they had to. That's how Stalkus had written the book. But it is interesting that he chose to start it there as well, because you do get a sense that you're getting this kind of overview in the first episode. So it is Hector's episode, but you're really getting an overview of everything. So it starts with someone that essentially is quite superficial in some ways, but that's chipped away as well throughout the episode. And I feel the same thing happens to Anouk as well. I mean, when you first see Hector, he's working out in the morning. Well, he's thinking of Connie, firstly, and of this affair that he wants to start. He's a public servant. So there's this kind of, this funny thing where it's like, it's this incredibly superficial, attractive man who's working in probably a pretty boring job, who's got two kids, lives in the suburbs, you know, doesn't have the best relationship with his wife, but there's a lot of love there. And Anouk, I kind of felt she's got everything you would think that someone would want, you know, but at the same time, she hasn't got what she really, really needs, which is a proper understanding of herself, which is why she's writing this novel, I suppose, to try and work that out. But they're both like little children in lots of respects, and I think each of them, by the end of the episode, has had something chipped away, I guess, by their experiences in that episode that make them reconsider where they're at, but also how they fit.
So episode one, as you said earlier, episode one deals with Hector's 40th birthday party, the barbecue, the slap, and where we leave off, everyone's going home, and then you're left with Aisha and Hector kind of reeling, like dealing with the end of the day and the wrap up, and you get to see how what their marriage is like and how they interact. With Anouk, it's going kind of the opposite direction, because she has quite a younger boyfriend. They're trying to work out how committed they are to each other. In terms of like where these two episodes relate into the broader plot of The Slap, how did you read them?
Throughout the whole book, the thing that captured me the most was the adult relationships as they were reflected through what happened to a child, which brings into question whether or not the adults are really adults or whether or not they're kind of semi-adolescence, which Anouk really is, and she was obviously struggling with that throughout the whole episode. This reflection of childhood through her eyes, and she's an adult already, you know? Mm. You have so many points throughout it where she does things that you wouldn't think an adult should do, like she feeds the kids cake. when Hector has specifically asked her not to feed them any chocolate, and then she buys Connie and Richie a drink when they go and see her boyfriend Reese playing his gig. And so she's trying to kind of be on both sides, and Hector seemed to be doing that as well, you know. He kind of seemed to be trying to be on both sides, having this kind of flirtation with Connie, trying to kind of, I don't know, I mean, you could call it a midlife crisis. Maybe he is 40, so it's kind of that point. But everyone through this slap has to reevaluate where they're at as an adult, mm-hmm. you know, and what they really believe. It brings all of that into question. So in terms of how these two sections, I guess, of the series relate to the rest, it kind of sets up, and especially on a superficial level, as it seems to begin, questions that we don't really have to ask ourselves very often, because it's all just stimulus response. We've got these jobs, we go out and do all of this stuff, and mm-hmm. we have all of these opinions. But until something like this happens, until something quite dramatic like this happens, you don't actually have to question what you really believe in, because you're just constantly acting and reacting. It's not like you don't have a conscience or anything, but you can see that Hector was just completely besotted with Connie, and he was ignoring the fact that it was his 40th birthday, his wife was there, and he invites her to their barbecue. Mm-hmm. And he curses himself for doing it. But Anouk, you can see that she doesn't really want to commit to this relationship that she's having. But at the same time, she doesn't want to pull away from the great sex that she's having. She's so busy that she barely even spends time with her mother, who has cancer. Mm. You know, she's completely swept up in her world. But I do feel that when it came to the end of the episode, she found strength again in her writing, which I guess is a real way for you to not only work through all of your problems on paper and kind of think about them and construct them. It's a catharsis, I suppose, you know, and there was a sense that she found catharsis at the end of the episode.
That was Toby Leon and Kim Tan talking about the novel and the TV series, reviewing the first two episodes of ABC One's 8-part teleseries, The Slap. On the Corner is up next. Speak to you next week.